Ken Whelan, as always, welcome to Mooney Goes Wild. First of all, you're about to head off to... You're always either going somewhere or just returning from... In fact, we'll be talking about where you've returned from in about 5 minutes' time.
You should ask him, is he coming or going?
Are you coming or are you going?
Well, I'm never sure myself, Angus. I just always know I'm on the way. Anyway.
You've been to Cuba. I mean, the fascinating report from Cuba then and your exploits and almost being arrested on several occasions and
absolutely.
All that. And the shiny trucks and the vans chasing you all over the place. But what's happening in China?
The Chinese expedition is quite an interesting one. I work part-time in UCD, and UCD and a university in China called Shantou University, which is down in the southeast. It's in the South China Sea. It's about 300 kilometres or so northeast of Hong Kong, just to try and put it on the map.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a university that's 99% dedicated to marine matters. And as I say, there's a memorandum of understanding between UCD and Shantou. And the reason I've activated the cooperation is because of some work I've been doing with the Atlantic Salmon Trust and the Atlantic Salmon Federation in Canada. We've been looking at alternatives in terms of aquaculture because everybody knows at this stage that aquaculture is very much a growing industry. There's huge demands for aquaculture, not just the salmon aquaculture we've talked about before, but all of the other species.
And great opportunities in it as well.
There are great opportunities, but I think the big concern always is the environmental concern. And the area that this small cooperative group that I'm working with are interested in is the area of closed containment. Basically trying to see if there's a possibility of rearing aquaculture species enclosed in very large silos, either with pumped seawater or with fresh water.
So are we talking fish farming here, basically?
Yes, you're talking fish farming. And again, this is not a new idea. Indeed, the first job I ever applied for, which was decades ago, indeed it was in the last century, the first job I ever applied for was looking after a silo farm in England. And at that stage, it was quite primitive. And the idea was the water was bubbled through and bubbled out.
And but what fish were in that?
In that case, it was all rainbow trout.
Yeah.
And the idea was to produce massive amounts of rainbow trout and to be able to basically flood Europe with them. There was no great knowledge about salmon farming at that stage. But the idea now has moved on a step where we have this system in place now in many areas where people are rearing fish for enhancing wild stocks, where you can take in large quantities of water and then contain the water and basically recirculate it. And there are huge biofilters now available that can clean the water, reoxygenate the water, rejuvenate the water. So you use a minimal amount of water during a whole cycle of fish production over a period of a year.
And you're not putting
months.
Polluted water then back out into the ocean, which is what happens if you have the cages in the ocean in the first place. Contents from the cages drop down into the sea underneath and can be a problem if not treated properly.
And certainly, I mean, even in freshwater production, where you've, again, rainbow trout or brown trout, you've the same problem on a lesser or greater extent.
The problem, Ken, as I understand it, is that to feed, to get a kilo of salmon, you must put between 2 or 4 kilos of fish food into that salmon. So it's the equation doesn't balance out. Now, in these silos, presumably, you are not going to feed the fish on fish, you're going to use some other material. Is that right?
I think at this stage it's fairly clear that we're not going to move away from feeding fish on fish. I don't think that's possible because the actual nutrient content and the oil content and so on of the fish is just so important to the well-being of the fish. I think it's a fallacy to imagine that you can shift away from it.
Are there no herbivore fish that you can feed them on plants? What about carp?
Well, certainly you can in carp, but can I just complete the point if I might
on the fish,
because that's really the root of why I'm going to China. What we are very interested in at this stage, and it does relate back to the herbivore fish as well, what we're interested in doing is finding alternative components of the diet that we can feed in. And at this stage, there's a huge amount of work going on. People are looking at all sorts of different plant materials, soya, they're looking at different sorts of other beans, they're looking at algae. There's a very good program in UCG at the moment, the new Tramara program, looking at all sorts of possibilities with algae. So it's basically an open field at the moment. It's an open goal in terms of how this is actually going to happen. But it's very clear, Richard is right, we can't continue taking this quantity of fish and we can't take it in an irrational fashion.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to be a balance. And because of the pressure that's on the Chinese coastline at the moment, they are very conscious of their pollution problems. They are just chronic in certain locations.
So are you going over to China to learn, to advise them, or are you going over to learn from them?
Well, I'm going over to learn from them.
Yeah.
Because perhaps we might be able to do a little bit on the other side as well, because they're interested in dolphins and they're interested in some of the technology we have on the salmon side. There's a little bit of a trade-off, but it's mainly to learn what is happening in the context of the food. And they obviously aren't going to rear salmon, certainly not at the moment, but they are very interested in shrimp. They're interested in small marine fish. They have dedicated, for example, a full island off Shantou as an R&D site. So it's of a scale.
Well, that's huge commitment. In my ignorance, Ken, I assumed that salmon are the colour that they are because that's the colour that they are. And it was with interest I read today that they're not, that they, you know...
They're white unless they get the right food.
Unless they get the right food. That obviously in the wild they get it from the plankton, but that in farmed fish you have to actually put a colourant in. So presumably that's a problem as well.
Yeah, that's quite a problem. And certainly, interestingly, the only fish that seems capable of actually producing that colour are the salmonids. The salmon and the trout have this ability in their bodies to be able to actually present that colour in the flesh, whereas other species have been fed all sorts of colorants and haven't really developed the colour. But there is an interesting angle on that, in that at the moment, in order to make a farm-reared fish pink, we feed them with a synthetic material, a carotenoid. But some work that's ongoing at the moment looking at algae indicates we might be able to get natural components in the algae so that we could actually have our fish a much more natural pink colour from a natural ingredient.
And is there any research done to show whether or not the public would have an affinity with the fish that is pink as they expect it? Or would they eat salmon, white salmon, and not feel there was anything different? Would it affect taste? Would it affect perception of taste?
It affects more perception than reality. And there was a huge series of tests done in Canada, if I remember right, about 15 years or so ago, where they took all sorts of different varieties of salmon with different stages of coloration and so on in them. And consistently, the idea of having, they aren't really white in it, they're kind of a very strange grey colour. And it's quite a natural colour for the flesh to be that. That was very off-putting. People just did not like that.
Mouldy. You'd think the fish was gone off, I think, if you saw sort of a dirty grey colour.
The taste was fine. And when it was presented in a cooked format whereby they couldn't actually see a colour, there was no issue. It was the idea that we have been trained into the idea that we need pink salmon.
Now, Ken, you mentioned that you have experience of this kind of thing with rainbow trout in Britain decades ago. What sort of problems did you run into with the rainbow trout, or has that gone on?
Well, sensibly, they decided not to give me the job at the time. So, I think British
well,
Oxygen...
You'll be able to attack them on air, so
please
have a
why go. Why have you eaten?
So I think British Oxygen Company are now thriving still because they made that correct decision. But no, I did obviously watch what was happening, and certainly at that time, that system broke down mainly due to fungi of various sorts. Because what happened was, if you had a very automated environment that was ideal for the growth of fish, it was also ideal for the growth of some nasties that you didn't want in there. And what tended to happen was you tended to get some fungal spores coming in the freshwater inlets, and then suddenly you had the perfect environment for them. You hadn't got the big biofilters they have now, and suddenly
the whole thing was overwhelmed. Yeah.
Completely overwhelmed, because it was a sort of monoculture issue. And they're still struggling with that today in the context of the closed containment. How do you deal with large numbers of fish in a very controlled environment?
Do they fish farm the same way in China as they do here, or do you expect to see different circumstances when you go over there to what you know here?
I just expect, and I don't know, this is a fact-finding mission. I have no idea really what I'm going to find. I would expect that at this stage, it's very much more an upgrading of their traditional approach. But they have one interesting philosophy, which I think is fascinating. And you're all going to learn a word now. I'm not sure whether it's a new word or not, but this is
the
idea of aquaponics. And
I tell you, it's the only topic of conversation every evening at the dinner table in my house. How's your aquaponics?
I'm disappointed now that you'd be able to grasp it.
I have no idea.
He's sneering at you.
But it's quite interesting. It's the idea of blending plants with fish. So in China, because traditionally they had such an interest in intensive rearing, particularly as Aina mentioned earlier, in terms of carp and also in terms of land animals, mm-hmm. they always had this philosophy, waste nothing. So the idea was that if you had fish and the fish were releasing the effluent that was mentioned earlier, well, then you use the effluent by basically either growing a crayfish that might feed on it, or indeed you might even grow plants. So the idea of having the plants and the aquaculture, blending them together and having what we call integrated aquaculture, that's huge in China. And I'm really looking forward to seeing how they go about this and how the philosophy works, because it makes so much sense. That
so
rather
the
excretions
from the fish is a nutrient for the plants to grow on.
Exactly.
And that breaks down the nutrients, exactly. And then the plants are there to be fed, not maybe to the fish, but to some other part of the food chain.
That's right. And the idea would be that you let nature take care of your problems rather than a situation where you create your own problems. So I think that philosophy could be really important to us in the future, because certainly with food security and so on being such a major issue, it may very well be we might look to plants now as a source of protein, but it might very well be that we need all the plants we can produce for human use. And we need to be thinking again then about producing even more plants by dint of byproducts from some of the other rearing systems.
You know, Ken, when I think about salmon, I think about them leaping up a river against the flow to spawn at the place where obviously they once hatched. And indeed, we're getting close to that time of the year to get to see the beautiful phenomenon that will be happening. December and January really are the prime months. But to get to the rivers, they have to come from the sea. And I believe that much less is known about the salmon at sea than salmon in rivers. And you were away at a big conference, was it last week in Amsterdam?
Yes, last Friday. I was very, very fortunate to be invited by the Pelagic Regional Advisory Council to talk to them a little bit about the Salmon at Sea programme that we discussed on Mooney last autumn, mm-hmm. The results from that. Because certainly some of the lessons that we've learned in relation to salmon have given us quite an insight in terms of what's happening in the oceans in general. I often describe them as aquatic canaries, because they travel far and loose, and they bring back in their scales, they bring back in their body chemistry, lots of indications as to how well the oceans are doing. And certainly the pelagic fish are fish like herring and mackerel that basically swim near the surface of the ocean and move very great distances, feeding on the plankton. And interestingly, the third member of that group is the salmon. Even though the numbers might be very small relative to the massive numbers of herring and mackerel, the salmon is in there. And certainly what we learn on salmon, you can then transfer over to mackerel and herring. But one of the problems we discussed on Friday was the fact that, unknownst to the fishermen, if they're capturing very, very large numbers of these fish, at times they are capturing some of the very small salmon, which you wouldn't even recognise as salmon by the time they've been squashed and so on inside these massive great
nets.
These
would be a bycatch on the herring or mackerel trade, and yet they're taking your good salmon that have left Ireland as the length of your finger, and they never come back. And this might be a reason that it's not the oceans that's changing, they're just getting caught in big fishing nets.
Well, all the indications are that the changing oceans is the big story. What we're trying to do at the moment is make sure that any of the additional pressures are reduced, because we did look at this in the past and it's extraordinarily difficult to try and get information on this, because, again, we got full cooperation from the fleets in Russia and so on to put observers on board the ships. We got observers in the actual fish factories themselves.
Well, that's not an easy task, I would imagine, in fact, you know.
Huge task, hugely difficult task. And also time is money in terms of those big factories. So the amount of time you can spend looking through a ton of fish, looking for these little guys that are 4 to 6 inches long, is very limited. So we got indications that certainly there were some fish there. How big potentially the problem might be, we have no idea. So what we really need is the cooperation of the people working in those pelagic fleets, so that we can do two things: learn more about the oceans and learn more about the potential impacts.
Ken, what do we know? If I was a smolt leaving the Shannon or some river in the west of Ireland now, I would go out into the sea. Would I head off like a bird on migration along a corridor with a definite destination up off Norway or something like that? Or would I just take potluck and swim whichever way I liked? In other words, do we know what the salmon do? Are there corridors? Is there a limited time that they will be swimming up past the west coast of Scotland? And when they get to their destination, then do they fan out? Where, if we could control the migration and prevent them being harvested by trawlers as they are on this migration, we would partly solve the problem, would we?
Yes, I think that's true. And if you'd asked me that question even a year ago, I would have given you the complete wrong answer, because the results from SALSI Merge, from the Salmon at Sea programme, indicated very clearly that there is a directional component to what the fish are doing. Again, these are very tiny fish. They're swimming out from the coast, from the Shannon, into this great big motorway of a current that's running north.
This is the North Drift.
The North Atlantic Drift, the Shelf Edge Current. So they're stuck in this massive great current. So they ain't going very far in the sense they can move left to right, but they really aren't big enough to be able to swim outside of that particular current. What we did find was that as we tracked, and we were in a position to do that, to be able to map the corridors, not for individual stocks in many cases, but for groups of salmon, we were able to track the corridors right up as far as the northern Norwegian coast. And what we did find was at least two occasions, the fish actually had to move current. They had to shift between two adjacent currents. So that meant there was a directional component. They actually were going somewhere rather than a situation where they were just at the mercy of the current.
So they got off one train and got onto a parallel train and went off in another direction. Now, do the salmon, like the way the birds do, the birds all go in autumn, the birds all come back in spring, more or less. But do the salmon go at a particular time, or do they leave the rivers all the time, or is there a certain time when they all go?
Well, again, just looking at it in terms of, if you like, the average best date that you could say was the peak of the baby salmon leaving is the 1st of May for Ireland. It's slightly earlier if you're in France or in Spain. It's later if you're in Norway. But for Ireland, it's the 1st of May. And all of the smolts will move at synchronously at a very, very common time. The reason being phenology demands, and that is where you get the interlinkage between the movement of the fish and their food, it demands they hit the ocean at a certain time so that there's a certain type of food available. But having gone out there, there's all sorts of choices available to them. Some of the choices are driven by genetics, some are driven by environment, some are driven by a mixture of the two. And the fish really are then a creature of their environment. So if they get to Norway and there's loads of food and they mature early, well, what else would you do except come back, have sex and lay eggs?
And that's what they're driven for. Current.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
But if they don't make it and they either decide because of genetics that they're going to stay for a couple of extra years or because their growth doesn't allow them to mature, they then stay for an extra year or two at sea and then they're big enough to swim. And they swim right across the north of Iceland into the Irminger Sea, across through East Greenland and around into West Greenland, and that's where they feed. So there's a lot of choices available to them, and this huge area of the ocean that they encompass, it's quite amazing to think that the little creature that's 4 inches that's leaving the Shannon in 2 years' time has been on a grand tour of the whole of the North Atlantic.
And how did they know where the Shannon is if they want to come back to it? I'm just, my little brain just can't comprehend all of that.
Just as well you're not a salmon, isn't it? We'd never see you again.
Well, there could be a blessing in disguise, as you.
Well, Richard will be delighted to hear this because certainly in the last 6 months we've had more and more discussions about the parallels between birds and salmon. And initially we thought there's really very little ground to see a comparison, but they are very similar in terms of what they do. This ability to be able to use these electromagnetic cues and the ability to be able to use the magnetic forces of the earth, that certainly seems to be a component. They're fantastic with current, really, really good with currents. And if you watch them in rivers, they're able to utilise all of the forces that are available under a waterfall to get over that waterfall without being confounded. So if they're so good at currents in freshwater, that stands to them as well in terms of the marine environment.
And do they smell the river that they're from?
Once they get in close, if they in within a distance to the river, then their sense of smell is impeccable. And what we believe is that in reverse, when they're coming back down, that it's like the layers in a cake, in the sense that the first smell that's laid down is the tiny little stream. The second smell that's laid down is a slightly bigger stream. Third smell is the river. And when they come back, they're hitting that smell sequence in reverse. So the last smell they got was the estuary. So the first smell they meet is the estuary. And some of them are really, really good at finding their way home. Some of them are hopeless at finding their way home, about 8 or 9% stray. And then the bulk of them are OK.
And what happens to the strays?
Well, again, they go into other rivers. And what we're finding at the moment, which I think is really interesting, and we do need to get someone out there and get them to tell us whether or not this is true, we're getting reports back from Greenland at the moment that in the areas up towards the Northwest Passage, which are increasingly free of ice, there are now new streams beginning to appear for quite long periods during the summer, and that some salmon are nosing into those streams, which I presume is what happened after the ice age the last time. It was the strays, it was the fish that weren't that great at homing that happened to come into the streams.
Can I ask a silly question? You know, lots of rivers have been dredged, you know, all the flooding that we've had, so you've got, you know, thankfully the towns are benefiting by having a deeper base or whatever. Is that affecting the return of salmon fish like that?
Yes, it does. I mean, I think that's why we need to be really careful. I mean, we are still fairly ignorant in terms of the complexity of the lives of these creatures. And what we take as a well-known fact, it may be a lot more complicated than we think. So this whole question of biodiversity and ecosystem services and keeping nature intact, that is so important in the context of iconic species such as salmon, because unless you keep the whole of the environment intact, you may find that you'll be confounded by some of the problems that will emerge.
I mean, even yesterday when they had flooding in Westmeath and flooding in Clonakilty, they were saying, oh, the floodplains have been developed, whatever developed means, I don't know. But obviously it wasn't a good thing, because the river, instead of being in the floodplain, which should accommodate it, is now flowing around the school in Westmeath or flowing down the main street in Clonakilty. So your ecosystem services that were provided by the river were ignored, and the floodplain was developed, and now as a consequence, these places are paying the price.
Pat and Donegal has been on to say fish farms are pollutants and endanger native species with lice and pesticides.
Well, there's always this problem, in the sense that any sort of farming, any sort of intensive farming, has real issues connected with it. And our efforts at the moment, certainly in the context of the Atlantic Salmon Trust and in terms of the work I'll be doing with UCD and Shantou, try and make sure that any fish farm development that we have in the future learns the lessons from the past in terms of sea lice and pollution, and that we move forward on a sustainable basis.
Ken, stay with us. We're on 1850 715 900. You can text the programme on 51551 or email mooney@rte.ie. Ken Whelan is back with us now with Richard and Aina. Lots of people with comments about the salmon. And also, I want to talk to you about the three different sorts of salmon, because there I was thinking that I had me bit of salmon and I loved it and it was grand, and I would be a fishman more so than I'd never really order meat when I'd be out, or I'd never be buying steaks or anything like that. I love a bit of salmon forever. Anyway, Irish salmon farms are highly regulated. They do not pollute, says Donald Dunleary.
Well, they're certainly highly regulated, and in the context of pollution, in terms of organic pollution, certainly in Ireland we're very fortunate in that our farms are on the west coast, generally very large currents, and there's also a lot of wind. So I think any problems for us in terms of organic pollution from our farms would be absolutely minimal, except directly in the actual location of the cage itself. But it does mean you do have to keep a very close eye on it, there's no doubt about it.
A bit of an Adam and Eve question here. If most salmon return to their own spawning grounds, would that not lead to inbreeding? Surely it would make more sense to go to a different river than your brothers and sisters.
Yeah, that, I thought that was, that's a very, very good point. And it's one that biologists look at it with, give it great attention in terms of how these systems work. But what the geneticists tell us is that to avoid inbreeding, you need a minimum of 100 spawning pairs of salmon. So you need a couple of hundred salmon. And if you have more than a couple of hundred salmon, statistically, then you won't actually get inbreeding that you would expect. And because salmon produce such vast numbers of eggs, what you tend to get then is a situation where, with all of the different families of salmon that are in any particular stream, that there's a differential survival amongst the various families.
Ken, is there any evidence that males come back later than females? In the world of birds, for instance, you get time differences between the siblings and space differences between the siblings. The swallow will go to Africa, the male will come back to where he was born, the female will go a few tens of kilometres or kilometres away. So the brother doesn't meet the sister when it comes to mating time. So there's physical separation. Is there any equivalent of that in the river, that the male will not go quite to the same bed from which he arose and the female might, or the other way around? Or is there any evidence that he might
come
back
a
year
later? Or after whatever?
Well, actually, it's different in a very extreme way, in that the really important composition in terms of, or contribution in terms of the male sperm, very often are from fish that have never gone to sea. So the little baby salmon that are only a year old, the males can mature at a year old, and they can contribute differentially to a red. So if you have a great big female and a male, and both of those would have come back from the sea at the same time, and they're trying to lay eggs over a big bed of gravel with a big strong current, obviously the current is moving the sperm away. So the chances of the sperm actually meeting the egg are relatively small, so that the male lays a huge amount of sperm. But these little guys, these little precocious par, get right into the red. And we've great film of this that we made with Eamon de Butler some years ago, of the little male par actually in amongst the eggs. And they're much, much more successful than the big males outside. The big bristling guy isn't the guy who's fertilising the eggs at all. So we looked at some salmon reds when I was working in Burrish Ool, and in some of the reds we had 7 salmon contributing to the one red, where you had the big male, the big female, and 5 other little males. So nature has looked after it very well.
So size doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter at all. And what tends to happen is that
children had 6 different fathers.
Exactly. That's right.
If that's the case, then, Ken, in natural selection will ensure that males don't go to sea at all. They'll all stay around and do their fertilising at home and not bother with the excursion.
Although they wouldn't get her to produce the eggs at all. She needs a big fella to get her going in the first place.
Now, that would be overcome if she's... is that true? You're getting a selection in favour of...
Amos' point is a very important one, because the mating ritual is where the male actually rubs against the female, and that actually stimulates her to lay the eggs. These guys are very, very much smaller than the female. But I think, again, it's a safety valve, in the sense that if you're in a situation where you have loads of males, that's what will happen. But you will have situations where they may be spawning where you wouldn't have anything like the same concentrations of juveniles. But interestingly, when we had our big problems with the drift nets, and some of the rivers were almost denuded of salmon coming back, we now believe that that contribution from the little resident males was actually vitally important in terms of exactly what the listener asked, in terms of making sure that we had this spread of genes. Mm-hmm. And it was a very important contribution.
The 3 different types of salmon put me out of my ignorance now, because obviously I was aware of the farmed salmon, and then I thought it was the fresh salmon, full stop.
So there are...
No, you mean the wild salmon? The organic salmon?
That's what I'm saying, Amy.
So I went to Simon's Fish Shop and you asked for salmon. What you get there is your farmed salmon, isn't it? Generally speaking.
That's right. So you have 3 types. You have wild salmon, farmed salmon, and then farmed organic salmon. So in reality, there's 2 different strains, if you like, of salmon. And the organic salmon then are, as the name implies, they're obviously ones that are bred with a minimum of chemicals. And in some instances in Ireland, then some of the organic farms are offshore farms. They're farms where there's very strong current. So you're in a situation where you're producing probably smaller numbers of salmon because you're in a much tougher environment. But in terms of the current itself, and in terms of the physical nature of the muscle in the fish, it's improved as a result of having to really fight for its food.
And are they safe from predators?
Well, there's always an issue with predators in terms of those cages, but they have all sorts of seal nets and so on around them. There's a suggestion and a move now that we might move out to the Aran Islands with very, very, very large numbers of salmon cages. In that instance, if you have an orca, or if you have one of the really big sharks or whatever, that could be a really serious issue, is the issue of predation. Because if you have 1,000 or more salmon in a cage and you're a big, hungry shark, or indeed some other big marine creature, nothing really is going to stop you in terms of your efforts to get it out.
Am I right in thinking that there was some controversy where organic or fresh, or whatever you want to call it, salmon was being passed off, or sorry, the farmed salmon was being passed off, and how would you know the difference and how would you regulate it?
Passed off as wild salmon.
Yeah, it was a situation, if I remember right, that happened about a year or so ago, maybe a little longer, where there was smoked salmon that was being marketed as wild, whereas in reality it was farmed. And what you can do now is you can take a sample of the flesh, and with the tags that we've spoken about before on the programme, these genetic tags, basically like we see on the television in terms of CSI Miami and so on, the DNA tags that we have available now can instantly tell us where the fish is from. So if the fish has a profile, and in the case of farmed fish, it's very easy because they're generally from Norway or Scotland, or indeed they may be of Icelandic origin. Not alone are they from different countries, but they are line bred. So genetically, they have now shifted and they're quite different. And statistically, when a pathologist then, or a fish biologist rather, stands up in court, he or she can then say with, you know, whatever certainty, 99%
a reasonable degree of certainty, yeah,
they can say, no, it was of Norwegian farmed origin rather than wild origin.
Mick in Limerick has been on to say, in Canada, a fish farm is not allowed within 30 miles of a salmon river's estuary. This does not happen in Ireland. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. And certainly in different places, you have different regulations depending on the conditions. And that whole area of distance as to whether it should have been 30 kilometres or 30 miles or whatever, that's still very much debated as to where the appropriate line is. My own view is that each area of the coast is so different that you really have to look at it in
on a case-by-case basis.
I think it's very difficult to go and have a magic number because you may find exceptions quite quickly.
Pierce has been on to 51551 to say, a couple of months ago it was stated that salmon had returned to the Dodder River. Are these the stray salmon that have lost their way, maybe from the Liffey?
Well, myself and Chris McCulley found these salmon. I think I described this on the programme before when we were doing our book on sea trout on the Dodder last year. And the Central Fisheries Board and the geneticists in Cork are about to take samples to find out the origin of these fish. My own guess is that they are probably strays from the Liffey. That's probably where they're from. Having said that, there was a big study done recently that I was involved with on the Mersey in England. And the collection of different salmon of different origins that they found was quite extraordinary. They found a very big range of strays right along the east coast, from right along the east coast of Scotland and England, all appearing in the Mersey.
And if they breed in the Dodder, will their kids come back to the Dodder then? Will they become imprinted?
Well, this is why it's very interesting, because again, we're re-walking the pathway of the icebergs in the past, you know, the ice age. So what we have to do now is to monitor that and see exactly what happens. But the theory is that if they consistently come back, they will develop eventually their own strain. But we have no idea how long those things take. And in the context of climate change, it is important that we know how long they take.
Oliver Mullen wants to know, how do the tins of salmon in the supermarket be so cheap, Ken, if they're called wild Alaskan salmon? And also, what's the difference between pink and red salmon? 2 minutes, starting now.
Very quickly. In terms of Alaskan salmon, they are all wild, but where we have thousands, they have huge, huge high millions. So the runs are enormous and they can have a very big commercial fishery. The different colours are two different species of Pacific salmon. And the reason they're different colours is because they feed in different areas of the ocean on different creatures.
Excellent.